Merci, thank you. I'm very happy to be with you. I'll speak in English, of course. I'm sorry I don't speak Italian. My position is a quite interesting one because, of course, leading surveys and research department at the Louvre Museum is a very interesting place to analyze the situation of museums in France, but also at an international perspective. Of course, this position is interesting because I very frequently work with professionals, but also with managers and also with politicians. So I know quite a lot about the question of audiences, and I will talk, of course, about French policies, because history is very important, but also about the question of categorizing. France, the French situation is very important because French museums were, of course, a kind of model for museums in Europe. And to understand the current situation, I think we have to recall the revolutionary roots, which are very important. The cultural policy in France was based on principles which are in line with the values and the organization of a new state, supposed to build what the revolution called a new man. And these theories were applied to the creation of museums according to three principles: returning the heritage to the citizens, making the access easier for everyone, and building a French nation by preserving and sharing the heritage as a symbol of a memory, but also, and we don't have to forget it, as a morality. These principles in France lead to a centralist view of French cultural policy. It was encouraged and carried out by a state which was and is today both organizer and sponsor of public cultural action. And museums became the emblem of republican values. And the Louvre Museum, created at the end of the 18th century, is designed as a model for both French and European museums, as a keeper of masterpieces belonging to the people. From the 19th century, the French state supports the access to art, heritage, and education. But it will introduce a very significant difference between the accesses to common knowledge and to culture. This explains, to my opinion, the continuing debates about free access of cultural goods and products. Because access to school will be free and compulsory for everyone, but access to culture will be variably supported by free entry for some social categories and at certain moments. Since the role of school and families is considered as an essential complement concerning cultural education and the shaping of taste, this opposition between a free and obligatory education and an artistic education which is variably free and compulsory is still at the heart of the question about access to culture. But in fact, from this time, the question of what audience segment has to be prior occurs in the French public debate. Scholar-age children have to be reached. Art students, artists, but also teachers who visit museums and monuments with their pupils. And the tradition of free access for young people will always be reasserted in France, whatever the time and whatever the government. And this policy, mainly a pricing policy before being an educational one, has just been reasserted through the extension of free access for 18 to 25-year-old people, which Nicolas Sarkozy announced in last January after a six-month experience and evaluation of free entry in some museums and monuments. So, from the very beginning, the audience segmentations do exist, and they favor in France the youth and the working classes. French cultural policy aspires to educate the youth and the less gifted ones with culture, but also to enlarge cultural equipment to the whole French territory by creating local museums and equipments. Education mediation, even if the word is modern, territory equipment and pricing policies constitute the ground of French cultural policies. Contemporary audience policies have never abandoned these original missions. But from these principles, three phenomena have been reinforced during the last years, and they can be observed in nearly all countries. First of all, there is an always finer segmentation of audiences, which leads to distinguish always more numerous and specific categories: children, teenagers, families, working population, seniors, and individuals belonging to frail judge categories. French museums reinforce their means, creating audience departments and mediation competencies. But in second line, there is a continuous sedimentation of new missions without abolishing initial stakes. It leads museums to the obligation of answering missions which are always more numerous and sometimes even contradictory. To the mission of access for all will succeed various injunctions: cultural democratization, cultural democracy, diversity, social cohesion, interculturalism, and more recently, intergenerational stakes and cultural sustainable development. Lastly, one can observe the emergence of European worldwide stakes which are out of the state control and which have to find their place without abandoning national or local missions. And these multiple political injunctions and audiences segmentation represent a high level of complexity for the cultural action. So what is the current context of museums' audience development in France? We have to remember that from the origin, the question of financing and means to preserve and purchase artworks and to welcome the audiences will be asked for the French museums. After the First World War, the state of public finances leads to the implementation of a tax to enter museums, which was accompanied by numerous exemption cards and reduced fees for certain categories. The present tension between proper resources research and state involvement, between equity of access and economic constraint, is not recent, but has been reinforced. This pressure is due to the drop of public financings, but also to the conflict between a national cultural model and a political, social, and economic environment which has been fully transformed. And among the factors which weigh on French audiences' policies, the following elements can be noticed, but I think this reasoning can be applied to other countries as well. The central cultural state is not the only supplier of cultural policy anymore. Regions take a decisive place in terms of financing, management, and cultural policies. Museums are encouraged to compete and increase their own resources. Discrepancies in terms of museums' development get worse between huge museums like the Louvre Museum, with their international touristic attendance, and small or middle-scale museums, often located into out of the big urban centers and of attractive areas in economic or touristic terms. Although museums are today very attractive and keep their legitimacy thanks to their collections and their exhibitions policy, they have to face several levels of competition with other cultural and leisure goods, with new cultural genres, more topical, more attractive, and more festive, in particular among young generations. A competition with the spread of leisure and cultural activities at home, thanks to technologies. A competition with the worldwide overproduction of cultural goods and services. And lastly, national policies are weakened by the new influence areas and zone of the political and economic work power. They have to take extra-national networks into consideration and borrow the frames of international agreements and rules which can belie their missions. But there is a point which is very often neglected. Museums have specific difficulties to integrate these tensions for several reasons linked to their identity of non-profit organizations producing experience goods. They traditionally progress with regard of their lonely word of reference by mutually comparing themselves. They progress through imitation between emulation, exchanges, and rivalries. Museums are not used to open themselves to other sectors and other cultural models. On the contrary, and in positive, since their creation, museums have been strongly and culturally very international. Owing to their economic non-profitability, museums are forced to produce numerous speeches to legitimate their existence and their activity. That is why they permanently have to give proof of and justify their abilities to fit to new social needs. Another point is very important. The life cycle of museums is generally very short. In the order of less than 20 years, these organizations quickly become obsolete in terms of museography, of addresses to audiences, and to means and of means to answer social needs. For all these reasons, museums have to regularly renew their development strategies precisely because they quickly become obsolete, outdated in terms of social uses. The views and models they offer fast become obsolete, confronted to the high-speed evolution of social practices. And of course, this obligation of reactivity and adaptation is strongly intensified by the pressure of globalization, and moreover by the public finances crisis and the periods of strong economic recession. All these factors explain the importance of questions, thoughts, and speeches produced by museums about their audiences. So, in this context, how should we analyze museums' audiences' policies and their development? There is, to my opinion, a confusion which justifies shedding light on it as soon as one wonders about the terms used by museums' professionals to classify the audiences. Distinguishes, as it is the case, the seniors, the culturally diverse populations, the people with physical disabilities and the youth is a classification. It has been called categorization by science, in particular in France, since the 18th century. It is an operation made on the basis of common or close enough criterions. For a category to be valid, the belonging criterions have to comply with some principles. Simplicity, unquestionable character, facility to collect them, and durability. Of course, categorization has a particular meaning and an interest for the one who produces and exploits it. But at least three different levels of categorizations go through museums' activity. Cultural action is the first category. What audiences have to be reached? Professionals create categories to carry out their action. Analysis is the second category. What are the effects of the actions carried out beside the audiences? Managers, politicians, but also researchers call them up or produce them. Social uses constitute the last register. What practices, uses, and values are associated to museums? Here is taken into consideration the demand and opinions expressed by the citizens, whether users or not. The action category is the one we are going to focus on today. It leads to highlight four main audiences families, perceived as consistent and important enough to justify a distinctive approach. Among these families, socially excluded individuals and youth constitute traditional museums categories. But the people with physical disabilities and the culturally diverse populations are more recent because they obey a new social acceptance, the legitimate existence of such social families, families which were, until a recent time, hidden or denied by society. The action categories enabled the museums to draw up their audiences' policies in a structured way. On the other hand, it raises some questions. How to ensure it is relevant to focus one's efforts on these specific families? How to grant that other social groups have not been forgotten? Another question deals with the relevance of a classification which would be identical between all museums. Indeed, museums do not have the same audiences, and most of all, are not enrolled in the same social, cultural, and economic structure. Each one depends on a particular social area, is confronted to the importance or the scarcity of the local cultural offer, and depends on its collection's nature. This leads to an interrogation which is likely to harbor the thinking on museums' new audiences. Does not each museum have to draw up audiences' categories which will be the most useful and operating in relation to the territory it belongs to? Action categories have another purpose. They are directly useful to introduce a dialogue of management between cultural actors, managers, and politicians. Categories have to make possible the measuring of the social and cultural performance and to negotiate the means and resources of public action. In this management dialogue, administrators and politicians can be led to use other categories necessary to justify and legitimate their action and the allocation of resources. Therefore, they produce indicators which are directly necessary, but we do not always correspond to the ones used by cultural actors. This especially explains difficulties made by professionals and administrators in their dialogue. A second level of categorization, essential in terms of cultural practices, results from the research in human and social sciences. Since the appearance in the middle of the 20th century of the sociology of culture field, it has provided a frame of analysis and interpretation of social, collective, and individual dynamics and of cultural policies effects. Yet, the categories of research analysis do not completely cover neither the categories of professionals nor the categories of managers and politicians. The study of social practices and of determining factors of cultural participation produces criterions, notably sociodemographic, but also of cultural taste and experience, which cannot immediately be translated into action categories for professionals. This explains the repeated difficulty met by cultural, but also by social actors to use the study's results. This confusion between unity of action and unity of analysis, scarcely criticized in the frame of the public policy's development, represent a major complexity for the cultural action. But a third interpretative level is still forgotten in the debate. The analysis categories usually used by human and social science to classify social factors such as practice and non-practice, level of education, taste, or life cycle do not permit to exhaust neither the individual cultural habits nor the worth they attach to cultural goods. This question of the value of cultural goods is still largely neglected. Cultural goods are goods of experience. They cannot be compared to other marketable goods. By taking the point of view of a citizen user, one can try to understand how this later considers himself in his relation to the cultural participation or non-participation. But cultural audiences are usually observed by cultural institutions, but almost never by their territory of belonging and uses, territory which is administrative, political, geographic, but also symbolic. This leads to over-represent the most faithful and frequent attendees. Individuals are first inhabitants and citizens of an area, a city or a community. They depend on an outfit of individual and collective services. They have at their disposal networks of goods, practices and uses, real or symbolic, to which they attach an interest or do not, and to which they have access or have not. If one reversed the look of museums at the audiences by positioning oneself on the side of the dynamics which facilitate or obstruct the access to art and culture, it will bring a precious light to the museum's vision of their audiences' categories, because research is very incomplete on the cultural and social role of museums within territories. It would be profitable to address the question of categories from another viewpoint. The creation of value, not only economic, but also educational and social. The Louvre Museum is now designing educational and cultural activities according to a chain of value. By using an economic metaphor or figure of speech, we can say that museums produce wealth. It is essential to analyze cultural equipment's performance beside people who attend them or are reached, but also to analyze the so-called non-use values, which are not showed by the physical attendance of museums. Value of existence of a museum in its area, but also option or bequest value granted by your community to the museum, since the benefit of its presence is seen as available to the community's welfare, to present and future generations. Museums create a wide range of values and profits, whether effective or symbolic, direct or indirect, real or virtual, and these dimensions are weakly explored, while they are, in all the empirical studies, an essential part of the many benefits that citizens grant to museums. Thank you for your attention.
Well, Io devo ringraziare Anne per innanzitutto per aver sostanzialmente rispettato i tempi che erano stati assegnati e poi soprattutto per i contenuti della sua relazione veramente molto interessante, ricchissima direi, di spunti che spero ci sarà poi occasione di riprendere. Però penso che sia meglio a questo punto continuare a mettere carne sul fuoco, quindi chiederei a David di procedere con il suo intervento.